National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns, is brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check out their website at cybersecuritysummit.org for a list of their upcoming webinar series. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, and you've joined us for this edition of National Security This Week. We get together every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security. We're fortunate enough to be joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us learn more about national security challenges and opportunities. Occasionally, we're even joined by guests from overseas. We have a unique show for you today, and we'll be talking about Saudi Arabia, but from a number of different angles. Our two guests for today's show recently visited Saudi Arabia as guests of the Middle East Policy Council, and they were given a chance to see many aspects of Saudi governance and society in action. Our first guest is Hamdullah Bejar. I think I have that right. Hamdullah Bejar is a doctoral candidate at the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies at the University of Exeter. His research focuses on the identity politics of the Gulf region, to include the concepts of Orientalism, colonialism, and post-colonialism. Before joining Exeter, Hamdullah was a graduate student at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard University, and he earned a Bachelor of Arts in International Relations from Abant Ezzet Baisal University back in 2013. Recently, Hamdullah Bejar was named to the Middle East Policy Council's 40 Under 40 cohort for 2023. Our second guest has been on the show once before. Nick Hayen is the Marketing and Communications Manager for Global Minnesota. He was also the 2022 president of the Minnesota International NGO Network, and he's a member of the U.S. Global Leadership Coalition's Minnesota Advisory Committee. His personal blog and podcast project, The Orientalist Express, seeks to educate all people from about American foreign policy by making international issues exciting and relevant. Nick Hayen originally grew up in the small town of Mitchell, South Dakota, and completed his undergraduate degree in world history from the South Dakota State University. And after completing a master's degree in Middle East history with an emphasis on international relations from the University of Utah, Nick and his wife Hannah moved to Minnesota in 2014. Hamdullah Bejar, welcome to National Security This Week.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
What time is it over in the UK right now?
It's 3 p.m. I am joining you from Exeter from my campus. It's a pleasure to be with you.
All right. And Nick Hayen, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here again.
All right. So we have a lot to talk about today. I'm really excited to hear about your firsthand visit to Saudi Arabia, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. But let me begin by asking both of you how you managed to get tied into this eye-opening visit to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. What was the catalyst for that trip? And could you give us a bit of a rundown on the travel itinerary? And Hamdullah, let's start with you.
Well, the program, as you mentioned, was made by Middle East Policy Council and co-sponsored by Saudi Gateway with their cooperation, a cooperation that normally do this kind of trip with undergrad students, actually. We were the first cohort that was with professionals and older generations, let's say. So for me, it was not my first time to the region, but it was first time to Saudi Arabia. I have been to the region, mostly to the UAE and Qatar and Oman for my field works between 2018 to 2020. Despite I have never been to the Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia has always been one of the themes in my research, in our, in general, for the, when we speak about the Gulf in general, you cannot ignore Saudi Arabia. Yeah. So, I think for me, the trip was important to see whether or not, the image of the Saudi Arabia fits the reality that we are having in academic and political analysis discourses. So, I considered it as an extension of my fieldwork, if I have to be honest with you. So, on one side, I wanted to see, many Gulfi, many Khaliji actually consider Saudi Arabia as a big brother, both as a cultural aspect and with a small connotation of Orwellian big brother. So it was a moment for me to see how these two different meanings of big brother play in the region.
Okay. Yeah, and I think for me it was a very much kind of a similar story. I'd never spent significant time in the Middle East outside of one day in Istanbul, which I know doesn't necessarily count as, you know, true experience. So despite having studied this region and Saudi Arabia specifically for so long, it was nice to finally have some significant time there. So I actually originally interned with the Middle East Policy Council about 8 years ago, and then reconnected with them through this 40 Under 40 Rising Leaders program. And so we spent about 12 days in Saudi Arabia as part of a cultural and educational outreach program. And so while we were there, we spent a few days in the capital, Riyadh. Then we went to Dammam to visit Saudi Aramco, then Al Ula, which is sort of an old cultural heritage site. And then we finished the trip in Jeddah with some stops in places like the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology and the King Abdullah Economic City. And so while we were there, they also provided us with some panel discussions featuring, I believe it was Dr. Mansour Al-Marzouki, who is actually the director of the Center for Strategic Studies there, and Hoda Al-Halassi, who was one of the first women appointed to the Shura Council. So we got quite a bit of experience with both the cultural side of things and the social political side of things as well.
So, Nick, it's probably important, the Middle East Policy Council, what is that organization? Can you sort of clarify that for our listeners a bit?
Yeah, so Middle East Policy Council is a D.C.-based think tank that focuses specifically on, of course, the Middle East and Middle East-U.S. relations. So they have several conferences on Capitol Hill every year, and they also produce sort of a quarterly digest of various topics on the Middle East. So that was one of the two internships I did in D.C. about 8 or 9 years ago. And so it was really nice to reconnect with that. Now they have this 40 Under 40 Rising Leaders program that they do every year.
So for both of you, what surprised you on this trip? Maybe two or three things you saw which you didn't expect to see, things that really opened your eyes to the politics, the economics, or even the security aspects inside Saudi Arabia, things that maybe you didn't know about before or maybe challenged your assumptions. I think all of us, and me, I will freely admit to this, we make assumptions about the world every single day. But when our assumptions are upended by facts or by events, especially when we can personally witness something for ourselves, hopefully we are forced to reevaluate our assumptions. Me personally, I'm just going to say this, I wish more Americans would travel abroad. Every time I've done so for my 25 years in military service or on the rare vacation, I've always come away with a far better understanding of other people and other cultures. What can each of you tell us about your experience in Saudi Arabia along these lines? Maybe two or three things. And Hamda, let's start with you.
What surprised me most, or I don't know if it's considered a surprise, but one thing I was really looking for and found my answer was to see the level of changes and the historicity of these changes. Like now we, when we talk about Saudi, about the changes, we mostly collect them like under the name of reforms, Vision 2030, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. So I was really looking for an answer, like, first of all, like, do we have reforms on the ground? And second of all, are they very recent? And I think, like, I don't know, maybe they were fastened, but I think I was surprised to see that these were like these all reforms are continuation of their national policy. Like, I can give an example, and like you can imagine the historicity of the. In one of the panels, we were told that King Abdullah Scholarship, which is a program to provide a tuition and stipends to the Saudis overseas, they have like around 500,000 students so far. So 500,000 students like studied abroad in the US or in the UK. And I can relate to this. Like when I was in the US, I had so many friends. So many Saudi friends from coming with this particular scholarship. And when we were having this kind of discussion a lot, like this was before Crown Prince was a Crown Prince. And they used to tell me, like, this scholarship is not only about education, it's about liberalization of the country, it's about, like, creating a human capital, making the country more sustainable in terms of human capital. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, even though like now they are branded in a different way, in a more ambitious way, I think like I was, I don't want to call it surprise, but like I think it has a history. These reforms has a history, like with the oil money that they have. They wanted to leave a footprint to the kingdom. Another thing that surprised me was about the like extensive cultural projects that they are building. I think Nick will also talk about this, but two different projects are taking place. On one hand, they are building like cultural project, which is directly about the Saudi family. They are like 200-300 centuries, like the Diriyah projects or the place where they were born. But at the same time, we have seen a lot of like emphasis on pre-Islamic history, or also like the 100 or 200 of the prophet period. So I think this was one of the two things that I was surprised and like I wanted to bring them to the agenda.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very, very quickly for our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guests today are Hamdullah Bejar and Nick Hayen, both of whom recently visited the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia on a trip organized by the Middle East Policy Council. We're sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. You can learn more at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. And Nick, how about you? Two or three things that that you saw on the trip that really sort of surprised you.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with Hamdullah, especially about the embracing of the pre-Islamic past. Because, you know, for decades, Saudi's strict interpretation of Islam kind of ignored or tried to suppress anything that hinted at the world before Islam. You know, it was almost like the Prophet Muhammad, you know, started the faith and then everything came after that. But now these relics and sites are being celebrated much more. You know, granted, it's a little bit of a push just for tourism, but it was still refreshing to see that embrace of the world that existed and that sort of celebration of previous cultures. And then I would also just say the social changes and the extent to which things are vastly different than they were even a few years ago. You know, it's so much more than just allowing women to drive, which is the thing everyone thinks about. But women no longer need to be veiled. They can go out without a chaperone. The religious police were essentially nowhere to be found. And people are free to mostly go about their business. They can go on dates now. They don't have to drive all the way to Bahrain just to go on a date with someone. You know, see movies, listen to music. Still, you know, quite a ways to go from a quote-unquote Western perspective of what you would think of free and open society, but still just dramatically different from what life was like even a few years ago. And I think that's certainly worth, you know, celebrating.
We had on the show here Fahad Nazer, who's the spokesperson for the embassy of Saudi Arabia in Washington D.C., and he talked a little bit about those changes. And I think one of the things that's a driving factor for that is probably the demographics of Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, something like 75% of the population is under the age of 40. Did the two of you witness that? I mean, was it a really big population of younger people in the kingdom?
Yeah, I certainly noticed quite a few. I think it was actually like 70% or under 30 or something like that. But yeah, just a substantial number of people are really in that younger demographic, and they are the ones who are really sort of pushing for this type of change. You know, it's of course not a democratic society necessarily, but you know, the people at the highest levels of government are watching that and being aware of that and thinking that the vast majority of the society does want to sort of open up a little bit more and not be quite as close as previously. So I certainly noticed that on the trip.
Hamdullah, do you notice the same kind of thing, the demographics?
Yeah, I think like with the demographics, I want to talk about like my experience with my Saudi friends too. Like, I think in general, my Saudi friends, like mostly master and PhD students or graduates, at least for now, I don't know what will happen like after 5-10 years of power accumulation. They are very supportive to the government. Like when I say they support, I don't mean like 100% or in everything, but I think there is a great popular support in these reforms. Like so I think the youth, for now at least, for like currently speaking, I think they are very dynamic and involved in the affairs in the kingdom.
So I've seen the itinerary. Thank you for sending that to me. That's very interesting. On your first night, you met with His Royal Highness Prince Turki Al-Faisal. a very influential leader in the royal family. I looked him up during that evening session. What did you learn from Prince Turki Al-Faisal? Hamdallah, let's start with you.
As you have just said, Prince Turki Al-Faisal is a very influential, like both in within the kingdom and we, like in terms of U.S.-Saudi relations. He served as a U.S. ambassador, Saudi ambassador for U.S. What I realized with Turki Al-Faisal and in general with his family, I felt like two things. Like in addition to the to his like great attention to the U.S.-Saudi relations, as to my knowledge, or like I felt that like even Gateway King Saudi Arabia was partly sponsored by him. In addition to his attention to his Saudi U.S. relation, I felt like his family is still very close to the current branch of the royal family. And the second thing I felt like I think they are the intellectual part of the family. Like they have these cultural programs. They have a private university. They deal with intellectual, educational, cultural programs. So for me, even the conversation, like it was more about his experience in the U.S., but more in terms of his soft power initiatives than hard power initiatives.
Okay. And Nick?
Yeah, and I think that that soft power really speaks to just how he knows that that's really the best way to get connected with the United States. And I think it shows the importance of the United States to Saudi Arabia and how much they really want to rehabilitate their image, especially after the past few years. You know, I did go into this trip wondering how much is it going to be sort of a PR campaign versus like an authentic, you know, view of the kingdom. And I really came away thinking that it was much more authentic. You know, there was, of course, a little bit of flourishes here and there, as to be expected on this type of thing. But, you know, there really is that authentic, genuine change. And, you know, as you know, of course, John, the Saudis have been working really hard at lobbying within the United States to promote things like Vision 2030 and their social changes. They've reached out to you. I know they've reached out to me. And it seems like this campaign is in some ways the product of what Prince Turki is doing to try to restore a better relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. And I think that he is, you know, one of the few people who really remains on good terms with almost everyone in the royal family. You know, he's very skilled at maintaining that positive atmosphere. And so, you know, these educational projects really show just how much they're focused on maintaining that diplomacy with the United States. And so I think it's really encouraging. And, you know, we ought to lean into that. If they have something to offer us on that realm, we ought to, you know, lean in and embrace that a little bit.
I do want to get into sort of the regional security challenges and opportunities in a little bit. But we would absolutely be remiss if we didn't discuss one of the driving economic factors for Saudi Arabia. I noticed that on your itinerary, you had a visit to Aramco. You mentioned it in our early discussions. What exactly is Aramco? How does it function as a holding of the kingdom? And what did you learn about the company during that visit? Let's start with you this time, Nick.
Yes, so Saudi Aramco is, of course, the state-run oil company that is almost singularly responsible for the country's wealth and prosperity. You know, we all know, you know, things like Saudi Arabia's true oil production capacity is a closely held secret, since they like to throw that capacity around to change the global price of oil. Unfortunately, we actually didn't get to know too much about Aramco simply because of those strict security measures. We had a visit planned, but ultimately this was unfortunately cut short the day of, so we didn't get too much of a tour. I'm not quite sure why. I have theories, but I won't share that on the radio. On the plus side, that did give us some time and some others to hop over the King Fahad Causeway to Bahrain, since it's right there. But we did get to discuss Saudi's moves towards diversifying their industries. You know, it's clear to me that they're starting to make some of these moves towards diversifying their internal energy. But I think the plan is really to keep relying on exporting petroleum for the rest of the world as long as that main demand exists. I guess, a little disappointed that they don't seem to be too interested in leading tomorrow's energy generation instead of maintaining yesterday's energy generation. But I think that's one thing I want people to kind of take away from this trip is that Saudi Arabia and most of these other countries, they really do have their own interests to consider, and we need to remember that. You know, sure, we would like them in the United States to keep prices down, to help with our own problems with things like inflation, but that hurts their bottom line too.
Right.
So, you know, they're saying the right things when it comes to climate action. They're taking some steps towards that, but I don't think they're going to give that up entirely until it's no longer profitable. And Vision 2030 is meant to help offset some of that revenue, but I don't think it will replace that completely. And, you know, why would they drop such a profitable enterprise just because, you know, we in the United States keep saying, well, it's the right thing to do. Yes, we need to give them some incentives, though, to help push that change.
Yeah. And Hamdullah?
Well, Aramco plays a central role in the kingdom. Like, even though they have the diversification programs, the diversification itself is, like, through the Aramco's vision. Like, in every institution we have visited, you will see the great emphasis on Aramco, on the universities. Like, the university that they have a world-class programs. They are mostly the programs that they have, the resource development within the Aramco, or even the cultural projects. Like, either Aramco is one of their sponsors, or Aramco is, like, building the museum. Like, when the day we visited Aramco, actually, we were supposed to visit Aramco, but we end up with their, like, cultural place. It was, like, world-class museum, world-class exhibition, but it was made by Aramco. Or the library that they had, I don't know, like, they have so many world records on for the library. I don't remember them, but it was made by the Aramco. Aramco still plays, like, one of the most central role in the kingdom. Like, even the companies that they show as a success, for example, SABIC, the Saudi chemical manufacturing company, like, is owned by Aramco. Or, like, in their 2030s diversification, Aramco is still, like, the sole responsible for generating the money or generating the funds for these all projects.
So both of you have mentioned that the kingdom is trying to diversify their economy a bit. Our guests from the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. mentioned the same kind of thing. Aramco clearly has a huge stake in what is happening in the kingdom on the science and technology side. I would tell you that I did a little more research into Aramco to prepare for this show, and one of the things that they are working on, interestingly enough, is an algae-based fuel research program. Did you hear about that at all while you were on that visit? And if not, that's okay. The idea behind it was
I don't recall them mentioning that much. They did a little bit about hydrogen generation and, okay, like, you know, carbon capture, but they didn't mention algae. Actually, that would have been interesting.
Yeah, they have a whole thing on their website about the research that they're doing into algae-based fuels and the idea to scale up to a massive level of production. It's never going to come anywhere close to just pumping oil out of the ground and refining it, because it's already been made by Mother Nature and history. But scaling it up is one way to sort of diversify what they're doing at Aramco. And I know that, you know, with the science and technology research that they're doing at the different universities, they're also expanding into healthcare, right? I mean, did you hear about that while you were there, as far as the economy goes, the expanding capabilities research into health technologies?
They did mention that a little bit, and that was one of the reasons I was really excited to go to that trip and to talk about and to promote Minnesota a little bit, you know, through my role with Global Minnesota, that we want to try to foster these business connections. Because, of course, healthcare is a really big scene here in Minnesota, and mm-hmm. as we look to hopefully win the World Expo bid in 2027, which is going to be focused on healthcare specifically, you know, that was also another really big connection that I was hoping to make, and I think I help to bridge that gap a little bit, because that's one of the areas that I know they have a lot to offer and we have a lot to offer. So it's certainly an easy partnership that we can all work together towards.
Hamdullah, anything else that you noticed with regards to the economy in Saudi Arabia?
Like, I think we can talk also about the 2030, or is it like early for in both in our everyday conversation and also in the panels that we had, we were 2030, the Vision 2030 was something that we have talked a lot, actually. I don't know if Nick remembers, like I asked the question there, like the 2030. Like as a researcher, I am very skeptical to this kind of visions. Like I know, like every company, every institution, every state, even every family should have a plan. But when we make them about the numbers, about the records, I think we banalize the issues. Like it becomes a big, like, and we pass, not only banalize the programs, we also pacifize the people. I think it doesn't help the entrepreneurship spirits of the people. Like, they shift, they make the people like sleep, wait, in 2030, everything will happen. And it doesn't happen. Like, Tokyo also had a similar vision. Like, it is this year, actually, 2023. So the 100th century of the anniversary of the Republic. Like the for the brands they built, like the first electric car, the first like local this, that, yes, but when it is about the numbers, the statistics, they don't they are not very realistic, and there is no like you cannot ask well, you promised us this, but it didn't happen, because it requires an expertise to know whether or not actually they match the target. So when you talk only about the vision 2030, I feel like it postpones the present time to the future. Like I see a big problem, a big problem there. So I think I am a bit skeptical in general to these visions or to these programs. I don't know what Nick would say.
I think they really wanted to get the point across that they're really open for this type of external investment within the kingdom. And some of these programs, you know, some of this stuff kind of makes sense. There's certain areas that I know we could certainly, you know, invest in. I'm a little more skeptical about some of these mega projects, which they actually didn't show us too much of. Like, we didn't go to NEOM, you know, the new economic city. They didn't show us the line, that giant 100-mile long linear city, which I'm quite skeptical of that is actually going to work. Or the new the Mukab, which is just this huge cubed shaped city. Those I'm not quite sure that you can really like force a particular design of a city. You know, there has to account for organic growth, and I don't think that those projects necessarily do that. But you know, some of the projects I think make sense and are worth taking a look at. Some of the other ones, though, you know, might be a little bit too flashy for my taste. But overall, I guess I would say, like, it's better to try something than nothing in this regard. You know, they are clearly doing quite a bit of major economic investment and overhaul, and that's a good thing. But, yeah, some of the aspects might be a little bit too flashy for my taste.
All right, we're going to take just a short break to identify our sponsors. We'll be right back.
National Security This Week is sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. The Cybersecurity Summit brings together cyber experts from industry, academia, and all levels of government to explore challenges, solutions, and opportunities in the cyber arena. The three-day summit includes speakers, workshops, discussions about advancing a cyber career, and keynote addresses by top leaders from across the cyber community. Learn more at cybersecuritysummit.org.
And we're back here at National Security This Week with our guests, Hamdullah Bejar and Nick Hayen. And we're going to tap into the expertise that both of you have on Middle East affairs, if we could, in the second half of our show. Both of you are very familiar with what's happening around the Middle East region. And with your trip to Saudi Arabia, I think you probably saw some things, heard some things that might have impacted your perspective on what's happening over in that part of the world. I definitely want to talk a little bit about the situation in Yemen, but before we get there, let's begin with the recent rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, a deal that was brokered essentially by China. What do each of you make of that deal, and what are the ramifications for that deal for the region? The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has traditionally been a strong U.S. ally. I think you probably heard while you were there that they still consider the U.S. a critical ally. And certainly the Saudi Arabia, the government, has been a buyer of U.S.-made military equipment for many, many years. Is there a shift happening wherein Saudi Arabia is now looking more towards China as an important partner on the global stage? I mean, I've seen some really good press coverage of Xi Jinping and the Crown Prince together. What's your take on it? Hamdullah, let's start with you.
Well, very timely question, actually. Like the whole last 2-3 weeks, the whole foreign policy, the regional news are about stories from this particular deal. And this deal was considered by many Western experts as like the rise of China or the fall of U.S. hegemony in the Middle East in for Saudi Arabia. Like Saudi Arabia has always been considered a very like one of the closest ally for the U.S. So, but I'm not sure actually about this, if this is completely true. I think the role of China is a bit exaggerated in this particular deal. Like I'm for sure, for fact, I know this negotiation between Iran and Saudi Arabia have been like at least for 3 years. I remember the previous prime minister, Iraqi prime minister, Mustafa Kadhimi, had like brokered negotiations with these two countries. And it was like the deal was very close. What happened to me is, like, it seems to me, both Saudi and China gave a clear message to the U.S. Saudi Arabia actually, like, had a two birds in one stone. So now they build a relationship with China, like, they diversify their foreign policy. At the same time, they give a clear message to the U.S. You are not, like, we can replace you. Like if you take your hands from us, if you don't want to be a partner with us, if you like don't have a good relationship with our leadership, we can always have we can always find a new partner. But I think this is a message. Like this is a more rhetoric than like real implications. I at least for like very near time, I don't believe like China will replace U.S. At least not militarily. So if it's not militarily, I don't think like the rest of the relationship matters as much as it would if it was militarily. And for China, like from the Chinese perspective, it was like a short opportunity for them, like an opportunity that they will go to the headlines as peacemaker. And they did it. Like they filled the U.S., the vacuum that the U.S. Left aside, and like, let's be honest, the U.S. doesn't have a very like good concrete foreign policy in the Middle East for the last 15-20 years. Like it changed dramatically from president to president, and like none of the president, despite the change, none of the presidents actually have done like a concrete thing, a concrete policy. So I think Saudi will still continue to prefer U.S. as an ally, as a global hegemony. But of course, it will not miss the opportunity to have someone else as a backup.
Yeah, Nick?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with that completely. You know, we shouldn't overstate the importance of it. You know, I think it's a step forward for both countries, but we're a long way from seeing these nations suddenly becoming close allies. I think, like Hamdullah said, they were both very interested in reestablishing ties beforehand, which is really kind of the bare minimum that we're talking about here. And China was an easy partner to credit for that. You know, I'm from a marketing perspective, I could see that this is such a great win for them because they did all the work, you know, Saudi and Iran did all the work. And then China just got to come in and slap its name on it at the very end. So like from a marketing perspective, I love when something like that happens. But well, we got to remember that the U.S. is still an important broker in the region. You know, remember things like the Abraham Accords from a few years ago. And I think this example really shows it's one example of how we should understand what a multipolar world actually means and what it's going to look like. Sometimes China is going to notch some diplomatic wins, and the U.S. just needs to be ready for that and accept that. You know, it was a little ridiculous seeing all the dooming and the pearl clutching of this is the end of U.S. power in the region. Pack it up. Go home. We lost everybody. But it's really far from that. You know, Iran and Saudi walking back from the brink, that's an objectively good thing.
Yeah.
And we should be careful not to sabotage that just because we in the United States want to be at the head of the table when it happens. You know, China scored a diplomatic win this time, and it made the region a little more stable. Good for them. Now let's try to broker the next deal.
And one final thing about this rapprochement. If you look at the regional developments that happens like in the last 2-3 years, like if it is a rapprochement period in the Middle East, everyone is making up with the rest. Like we had like the 4 year long, the end of crisis in 2021, Qatar with Saudi, UAE, Bahrain, Egypt, then like Turkey is rapproaching with UAE, with Saudi, with Israel. So Israel, UAE normalized, like became the third Arab country who normalized relations. So I think it is very parallel to what's happening in the region. Like, it's not exceptional case. It is not like something out of nothing, out of blue. So so I think it goes to the, it goes parallel to the spirit of the time.
So there's a couple of pivots that I want to take. One, just a quick comment, Hamdallah, you mentioned the rapprochement that's happening more broadly. I've recently read that some of the other some of the Arab leaders have actually been sort of reaching out to Bashar al-Assad in Syria to try and reestablish a relationship after everything that has happened there over many years. So even that is happening in the region. What about the conflict in Yemen? Let me go to that briefly, and then I want to go back up to the big geostrategic issues. Did you hear anything about the conflict in Yemen when you were in Saudi Arabia? That's clearly, you know, something that's taking place inside Yemen, but it's become essentially a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran over who is going to have the most influence in Yemen. Nick, what did you hear or what have you read about or, you know, your experiences in the visit to the kingdom?
Yeah, so international politics was one of the areas they didn't talk about too terribly much. Kind of understandably so. They wanted to avoid some of those really contentious topics. But the conflict in Yemen was one thing that was brought up in one of our panel discussions. And, you know, it was, I guess, a little unfortunate because they kind of essentially mentioned that, like, they don't exactly expect too much to change, at least right away in the short term or the near term. They pretty much admitted that, you know, nobody really has too much of an incentive at this point to come to peace, at least in the short term. So I'd be a little bit surprised if anything sort of changes in that regard, at least right now. If something does change, I would think it would be because perhaps China here can play a little bit more of a role simply because they have more credibility, especially with Iran, than we do. And they have more leverage than the United States does. You know, right now, we're really kind of maxed out on sanctions against Iran. And of course, I bring up Iran because of the connection with the Houthis, although it's important to remember that the Houthis are their own separate entity here. You know, they're not beholden to Iran. They don't take all of their orders from Iran, but they do have some support there. So really the leverage there is potentially on Iran to help bring the Houthis to the negotiating table. But of course, we have no credibility with Iran because we terminated the Iran nuclear deal. And so China could put its name on a new deal if that were possible, in part because it really hasn't tried to do anything yet in Middle East diplomacy. You know, they're kind of a blank slate. They've stayed neutral for so long, and now they're starting to maybe pick some sides here. So if this keeps up, we could see their own, we could see them have to start to own some of these conflicts in a bigger way, and perhaps that diminishes their ability to broker power, to broker more deals like this in the future. But I don't know. It's interesting to see. I'm just not sure too much is going to change in Yemen, at least right now in the short term.
And Hamdallah, we just experienced a month ago the 8th anniversary of the Saudi Arabia-led coalition fight in Yemen. What's your perspective on that situation?
It has been almost 8 years. Like, it began in 2015, and like with no clear win from either parts. And also, like, I am a bit skeptical also about like the organic link between the Houthi and Iran. Like, of course, for now, Iran supports Houthis, but I'm not sure if like Iran has the leverage to bring them even to the table. And from Saudi perspective, I really don't know what is the final aim in this military operation. For UAE, for example, we know like UAE is interested for several reasons, like including in addition to like being a partner with Saudi Arabia, though not very sincere partner for this particular military, they have like strategic reasons. They have to. They want to open their ports. They want to be. They want to have a footprint in regional ports. So because of the strategic importance of Yemen, UAE wants to be there. The thing with Saudi, I don't know what is like. They consider it as a national security issue, but what is the scenario that they will stop? Is it like a unitarily puppet regime that they will put there, or is it like a more like failed state they wanted to have? But one thing that we heard from in one of in one of our panels was about the humanitarian aspect of it. And like I heard this before from someone else's. Saudis are very disappointed actually from the Western media and politicians in like not talking about the humanitarian aid that the Saudi have done. Though the humanitarian tragedy is also something that they caused, but like it was told to us like we donated I don't know how many billion dollars in these 8 years, but no one talks about the aid that they have done. Everyone is talking more about the tragedy, the crisis it was. So I think like only to know what they think. I think they many of the Saudi leadership sees like they help the Yemenis, not they are in the war. I can see this from the UAE perspective too. Like when they talk about Yemen, like they don't see it as a military operation, but more as a like as a national security which was caused by Iran. Like they prioritize Iran discourse than the fighting with the neighbor or like a regional peninsula power.
So I want to pull back out into a bigger geostrategic discussion briefly and you know, kind of cover the Middle East. We've talked a little bit about China's influence in this this agreement, this normalization of relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran. I've read lots of different analytical pieces from lots of different think tanks and from university and college professors who specialize in studying China and other parts of the world. One of the things we're hearing from China these days is, you know, we used to refer to the developing world, you know, as the third world. Then it became the developing world, and we started calling it the global south. I think it's still sort of considered the global south in many regards. China is now courting heavily all of these nations across what are called the global south, and it's not really the global south, but the global majority, and so they're trying to drive a wedge between Western policies led by the United States and the global majority of people who really haven't maybe benefited from the post-World War II security framework and economic organization of the world. And so there is a choice now that countries can make between the China way, where you have this sustained growth year after year after year, or, you know, the American-led way. And the Middle East is obviously a hugely important part of this global economy right now, principally because of oil and gas production. Where do the two of you see this happening in the Middle East region? How is it influencing politics and alignment in the Middle East for the countries of the Middle East between, do they look to the West, you know, America and Europe, or do they look to the East, to Beijing? Alhamdulillah, we'll start with you.
Actually, I want to go back to Nick's comment on what will happen if we live in a multipolar world. I think, like, having these two options itself is quite, like, give quite good leverage for most of the regional powers. As I have said before, like I don't think like China is like an hegemonic power, at least for the next one or two decades. But being able to like play with it against the U.S., normally like U.S. was like more dictating the policy to the regional powers, which like exclusively or implicitly you would accept it. Now, like, I think there will be second or third options. Like, we see this with the with recent Russian-Ukraine crisis. Like, not every regional power is following what U.S. says step by step. This doesn't mean, like, they support Russia, but, like, they consider their priority, their national priorities first than like U.S. or Western or European bills, let's say. Like I see this like when I compare my gas bills or electricity bills with 2020-2019, it's tripled. But I don't think, like, I think Nick will also have will have his views on this, but I don't think like Russia, Saudi Arabia, or like Qatar as a gas or oil exporter have to care too much about like the bill of British household.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And you've kind of taken some of the words right out of my mouth, I think. although I would, John, I would kind of counter what China is saying a little bit with one, it's a very convenient, you know, marketing push for them to say the global majority. But two, that I think that the you know, Western-led order after World War II, as it's called, I think that has benefited the vast majority of these countries around the world. It's just, it's been very uneven, both here in the United States and abroad. The benefits of that has been very uneven. But, you know, I think Hamdul is actually absolutely right where, you know, if we force them to pick a side, they're going to go with probably China in that case. If we sit there and say that, you know, you have to do all this stuff, like you have to, like we ask Saudi Arabia to cut oil production just because it punishes Russia for the war in Ukraine. Well, you know, we can sit here with our moral arguments and say, you know, well, people are dying in Ukraine. They're being threatened in Taiwan. And many of these countries are going to sit back and say, well, people are dying in my own country and I can't afford the costs of these sanctions on people like Russia and China. So all this is to say that we can't force these countries, you know, to pick a side. We have to instead find ways to encourage them to go along with our plans rather than to just simply scold them for not doing what we want. We have to find those incentives rather than just say, well, you should be on board with us because we say so.
Yeah, it's an interesting world out there. I mean, we've heard this term, you know, BRIC and now the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, mm-hmm. and now South Africa, that they have actually been working collaboratively to sort of build maybe an alternative currency to the dollar for international business transactions. And I just read last night that there are 17 nations that are actually applying to become part of the BRICS membership. So to your point, Hamdullah, there's sort of a rebirth of the non-aligned movement to a certain extent. India, you know, being a strong leader in there, the biggest by population and by participation in elections, the largest, the biggest democracy on the planet. But there's a lot of other things that are happening in the world that are changing from sort of a unipolar world that we had at the end of the Cold War to a multipolar world or a non-aligned part of the world that can use the competition between the two major powers to their benefit. We only have about 10 minutes left. I can't believe how fast this show goes by. Every week, I'm blown away. I do want to ask, Hamdullah, there's a very important election coming up in Turkey here very shortly, or Turkey, as it says, as the new name says. What is your prediction for this election? What are the main factors that people in Turkey are considering as they ramp up to the election?
Like from Saudi perspective speaking, like I think that Mohammed bin Salman had a long issue with Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Like he was, I think he considered him as a rival for a while. Then like he got very angry to him for some other reasons, of course. But after the rapprochement last year, they didn't take like very concrete steps immediately. But 2-3 weeks ago, I have seen a news, but I haven't checked if they have done it. Like there was a agreement between the central banks of Saudi Arabia and Turkey. So actually, they had a swap agreement for $5 billion, which was considered as a support to the government. But I think in general, like most of the other regional powers, Saudi is also sit and wait until the mid-May. They don't want to like take a part on any domestic issue about related to election, like as they expect the race to be very heated. So they don't want to support the wrong side, to be honest. Like so I think like from the Saudi or from the regional perspective, they cannot anticipate what would happen if the opposition come, as like one of the most heated topic is the refugee issue and the like Turkey's politics in Syria. So I think At least for the current government, they know how to play with it. But for the opposition, it is one of the exams, like the test they will have. We will see. I also wonder how will they do it in case if they win.
Nick, any thoughts on the upcoming Turkish elections?
Yeah, I think it's going to be quite an interesting show, especially, you know, a lot of people assumed that Erdogan would probably potentially run away with it. And then, of course, the very dramatic earthquakes happened and the poor response of the government since then. So now it's hard to predict exactly what's going to happen. I think it's interesting. You pointed out a recent article asking, you know, will there even be, you know, a transition of power should Erdogan lose? And you know, unfortunately, I think we've seen that in a lot of these cases, they're not necessarily going to go quietly should they lose the ballot box, and potentially, you know, they'll end up being ousted anyway. But it's not as seamless as a process as it used to be, unfortunately.
So we're down to about 7 minutes remaining. I just want to ask. There's two more questions I want to ask. So from each of you, Hamdullah, we'll start with you. I'll give you like 2 minutes. Final thoughts on your visit to Saudi Arabia. What else did you learn that truly surprised you that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I want to go back to our trip to Al-Ula, actually. Al-Ula was like, is a very ancient city and also was very popularized like with the rapprochement with the Qatar because the agreement was signed there. If you remember Al-Ula summit, the GCC summit was made in Al-Ula. Al-Ula apparently is a very historic ancient city, and it is built actually by the same civilization, the Nabataean civilization of the Petra, the Jordan Petra, and like the tour that we have taken and the archaeological research that they still continue to do convinced me that they like they want to have tourism more than Hajj and Umrah. Like and also, like we were speaking about this with Nick, the explicit emphasis on Hajj and Umrah as a new tourism on one side, and like on the other side, like alternative tourism to this, like was something that was like I was not expecting. There were explicit figures, like I don't know, 30 million people for annual Umrah visitors every year. They were expecting by 2030 or something like that. I like the figures might be wrong, sorry, but like I remember like there were some figures. So I think this was one of the things that I want to close with, that like they want to use every opportunity, religious, non-religious, Islamic, non-Islamic, to present Saudi Arabia as any regional, cultural or touristic hub. Alternatives maybe to Dubai or to Jordan, to Turkey, to Egypt. Like, I think this is one of the things that I want to have my last comment.
Heavy on the soft power. I like it. Nick?
Yeah, no, and Alhamdulillah, you were actually able to go on the Umrah, which was quite exciting for you. You know, the Umrah, of course, being the, so everyone knows the Hajj, you know, the great pilgrimage to Mecca. The Umrah, of course, is similar, you know, going to Mecca, but just not during the actual Hajj period. And I did think that was very interesting, the way they framed it more as a tourism opportunity, as a money-making type of endeavor. You know, it because there's lots of ways that Saudi Arabia is going to be able to make money. And I just thought this is a little bit of a missed opportunity, that you should be presenting this as the great equalizer, because that is what the Hajj is, you know, every person, every Muslim around the world is equal, regardless of political or economic or social standing there. So why not emphasize how this is the great equalizer around the world versus, well, we're going to make a lot of money because a lot of people are going to come to Mecca for the Hajj and the Umrah. So I thought that was a little bit odd in that regard. But one of the really big things I wanted to focus on is just the extent of the social changes and the political realities. You know, things are moving really fast. Nearly everyone is on board with it, and they approve of the way things are going, and that's enough for most of the Saudis that we saw there. We, of course, had the honor of speaking with Hoda from the Shura Council, you know, similar to Congress, although, of course, the Crown Prince and the King have the final say in everything. But Hoda mentioned that the concern in most of Saudi society is not towards democratic representation, but of good governance. If the government is running things well, then why would they take a chance to overhaul that entire political system? You know, after all, one could certainly say that American-style democracy doesn't look super appealing all the time these days. So that's something I think everyone should kind of take away from this trip, is we think everyone around the world strives for a representative style democracy like what we have. And that's not always the case. You know, sometimes people are fine if the system is running good enough.
So it sounds to me like what you saw over there was a benevolent monarchy in action.
It certainly likes to present as benevolent. There were definitely some things that were great and that could be celebrated, but certainly some things to work on as well.
So we'll have to sort of wrap it up there. Hamdullah Bejar and Nick Hayen, who both recently visited the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia as guests of the Middle East Policy Council, thank you for joining us today. Are there any resources you might highlight for our listeners? Nick, the Middle East Policy Council, what's their website?
Yes, so that's at mepc.org. They also have a website called teachmideast.org. That's great for getting to know some of these countries better.
All right, Nick, thanks so much for your time today. And Hamdullah Bejar, joining us from the University of Exeter in the United Kingdom, finishing up your doctorate. What's your doctoral paper on?
National Identity of the United Arab Emirates, the identity politics of the Emirates and how they construct the national identity.
And when do you defend that?
I am hoping to finish it in 1 or 2 months, hopefully.
All right.
I am in corrections season now. I am hoping to finish it very soon.
And you're heading back to Turkey to teach, is that right?
Yes. To very close to the country we discussed, very close to Russia. I am returning to Trabzon. Karadeniz Technical University, Bilecsi Technical University.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you both again
for joining us today. And that closes this edition of National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today here on KYMN Radio. Look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for being a listener to National Security This Week. Have a great finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns with host John Olson. It's brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check their website, cybersecuritysummit.org, for a listing of their upcoming webinar series.